I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about Amy Bloom's new novel. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Successfully erotic sex scenes are notoriously difficult to write, but novelist Amy Bloom has hit the jackpot in her new novel, Lucky Us. It's featuring one of the most glamorous orgy scenes of all time. This irresistibly steamy Hollywood party involves a room full of stars and starlets dancing, flirting, and seducing in the old Hollywood of the 1940s. More than the erotic adventure, so there are a host of characters in this new novel to cheer on, to kiss goodbye with sorrow or glee, and ones to love with all your heart. Above all, this is a story about the messy and precious lives all of us lead, and that sometimes we are graced enough, maybe smart enough, to see our human foibles as they are and become the people we hope to be. Named one of the great reads of the summer by New York Magazine and the recipient of many starred reviews, Lucky Us is perhaps Bloom's most cinematic, fast-moving novels in its scenes and scope. Each chapter title is a song from the 1940s, from Fats Waller's You're Not the Only Oyster in the Soup to I May Be Wrong, But I Think You're Wonderful, sung by a young Doris Day. Each of Bloom's characters deserves his or her own novel, from Eva with the innocent face and determined heart to Gus, the all-American auto mechanic and every woman's hero. There is Francisco, the inventive, fearless gay hairdresser, and his outrageous sisters Bea and Carney. The characters' lives intertwine in a way that is both lifelike and characteristic of Dickens and Jonathan Franzen. For fans of historic novels like those of E.L. Doctorow and Hilary Mantel, Lucky Us takes us into the past while making it feel like the present. Amy Bloom, who lives in Connecticut, is a National Book Award and National Book Critics Circle finalist. Her work has appeared 7 times in Best American Short Stories, and she is also a screenwriter. Welcome back to the show.
Always nice to be here.
Well, why make people wait? Let's talk about the sex scene. I am rarely satisfied with a particular sex scene, and these are so hard to do. And as I said, you hit it out of the park with this orgy of these stars and starlets in Hollywood in the 1940s. So let's get into how this was written, how this came to you.
I almost never say this about anything that I write. That was a joy to write from beginning to end. I made myself laugh.
I can tell.
I would look at it and realize that, oh, I had like a little flush in my cheeks. It was just so much fun. I think sex scenes often fail because they are either excessively lyrical or excessively clinical. Mm-hmm. But what they don't have is that feeling of surprise and that little jolt of electricity that actual sexiness gives you. And that's what I wanted. The entire thing is observed by a young woman just arrived from Ohio, 19 years old, has never seen anything like this in her life.
Is this based on something that, in terms of, I know you did a tremendous amount of research into this period. Is this based on?
Absolutely, this went on. And there are lots of first-person starstruck accounts of it. But because the men and women of the big screen were so controlled by the studios, their private lives were very private, and people tended to have private parties, private pool parties, private sex parties, private key parties, usually on the grounds of a beautiful estate that had a very high fence. And so this party, which is taking place with the marble floors and the serving people, both girls and boys, in white satin pants and turbans and topless, were in fact not unheard of.
Atmospheric and steamy. Let's set the scene. We're in the 1940s. What's going on in the world?
I think it's exactly what's going on in the world that made me want to set the book during that period. It's such an extraordinary time. And although what we tend to focus on is really the superficial, we love the look, we love the vintage clothing, we love the chignon, we love the dark red lipstick.
Which is all in there.
And I loved every moment of it, from, you know, having to paint on your stockings with a little bit of iodine and talc and eyebrow pencil to create the seam up the back when there were no nylons during the war. But the other thing is that it is a preview. It is the crack in the wall that will lead to the modern world. Because we had a war going on, we had to face a certain amount of integration in the face of strong segregationist impulse. Because we had a war, we had to let women wear pants and go to the factory and get promoted. There were guys running factories who had never worked with women in their lives, and when the war ended, they begged the government to let them go on employing women.
We have the president at the time is in here. We have Hitler. We have all kinds of things. But here, in a way, that's from looking up on high. Mm-hmm. This is a very intimate novel. You get deep inside the lives of these characters. So let's begin. Tell us about some of these characters. There is Gus, the all-American hero.
I love Gus. I mean, Gus, to me, he's a straightforward guy. He sees something special in our hero, Evie, even when she is 16, and knows better than to pursue it. But he is one of those men who's big enough and strong enough to also be gentle. At one point, Evie describes him as the kind of guy who would not only rescue you from a burning building, but run back in to get your poodle.
He is a great, great character. And it is the way you do this with him is intriguing to me because you don't quite know it. You know, this is evolution. This is a novel at its best, I think, where you meet him, you say, interesting guy. But as time goes on, you realize all of a sudden I thought, I am in love with Gus. I love this man. Man or woman, this is the kind of person you want to have as your friend, your lover. This is the guy. Tell us about Eva.
Eva is certainly one of the characters that I strongly identify with. Eva is the girl with the big glasses and the big books. She is the girl who is watching the world, but who is also, because she is in many ways orphaned, forced to become her best and bravest self. Although, as she would say, there is nothing in her that feels brave. She feels that she is the person who would be shrinking against the wall as the soldiers ran past her, whereas it is her glamorous sister who would be saving babies and rescuing people.
And yet that wariness that she has, you know, from her life circumstances, and you see all this happening, that wariness she has is useful. It gives her a distance, a judgment. She has this ability to discern people's character, even when she doesn't think she does, you know, and so you end up rooting for her in this way, not only because of her vulnerability, but because you can see a blossoming wisdom in her.
I think you can, and it's wisdom and it's action, because she does not live in a world where you could just muse about possible courses of action. She has to survive. She becomes a mother at a very young age and completely unwillingly, and nevertheless has to do her best.
So let's talk about the opening of your story. I love to do this. And then I'm going to ask you, of course, which of your characters you identify with the most. But here's the opening of the story. It is riveting to me from page one. Go ahead.
The opening of the story is we meet Eva and her mother, Hazel, who is a waitress at a crappy restaurant in a small crappy town in Ohio in 1939. We proceed to Eva discovering that her father is not just her father, but also the father of another girl a little bit older, and also the husband of another woman. And Hazel, her mother, who is somebody who always has her eye on the main chance, a steel-plated opportunist, says, "Let's go down and see what's in it for us." And they drive to her father's house.
I'm Faith Middleton with novelist Amy Bloom, and her new novel is out. It is called Lucky Us. We have a review of this online at WNPR.org. It's there right now. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. Of all the characters, which do you identify with the most?
I think I identify with both Eva, in her observations of the world, in her wariness, and in that position of being the kid on the edge of the playground who is watching everything and trying to make sense of it. I also identify with Iris, who refuses to be stopped by obstacles like other people. I wouldn't say I identify with her. I should say I sort of admire her ruthlessness. I don't share it entirely, but I wouldn't mind if I had a little more of it. I identify with Gus, who recreates himself and comes back to America, having been in a displaced persons camp in Europe, and sees his country differently than he had before. You know, they're all characters I strongly identify with. I have to say that Edgar, who is the father of Evie and Iris, who is one of the great con men of all time, is not someone I identify with, but I see my father, who was not a con man, who was a very respectable, you know, hardworking guy, but I see my dad in him all the time, in that sense that education is actually what you learn, not where you went to school, and that what you know and how you make use of that is more important than how you were born.
Tell me about opening each chapter. Each chapter's title is a song title from the 1940s. And, you know, was so well chosen, I have to say, from, as I mentioned, Fats Waller's You're Not the Only Oyster in the Soup to I May Be Wrong, But I Think You're Wonderful, which is sung by a young Doris Day.
I love music. I listen to music all the time, and this was a great period, the rise of pure jazz, swing, honky-tonk. It was just a tremendously inventive and blossoming period of music. And so getting to listen to it was one of the great pleasures, I have to say, of my writing and listening life. And so many of the song titles are evocative that the truth is you don't have to know the song to be moved by the title. You know, if you know the song, it adds something to it. But if you don't know the song, even the language of them, By Night and By Day, you know, Dreaming of You, or my favorite ones, literally from World War II, Hitler Has Only Got One Ball, one of the funniest songs I've ever heard in my life, and was sung by American soldiers overseas in the height of the war. Or right at the end of this period, Did You See Jackie Robinson Hit That Ball? Done by Count Basie, I believe.
Now, here's what we've done, because I'm setting you up really to talk about the music, because we have linked to Amy Bloom's website, because all the songs from all the chapters are there. And so if you go to us at WNPR.org, you will hear all of this music, and you can read the review to these songs playing or listen to them while you're reading the novel. But it is a great, really fun thing to do. Amy Bloom, whose new novel is just out, Lucky Us, and we will continue our conversation after this quick break. I'm Faith Middleton. You can find what we talk about on this show online right now at WNPR.org. We're in conversation with Amy Bloom. Her new novel is just out. It's called, it's a great read. Oh, boy. It's called Lucky Us. It is set in 1940s in Hollywood. There are stars and starlets. There's a gay hairdresser and his outrageous sisters. Each chapter is titled after a great song. Song title from that period. And in fact, we have a link to all these songs at our website right now, and you can see the review I've done of this novel at WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. The point is that if you like historic novels, I do, I will never get over E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime, and of course there's Hilary Mantel. This is one for you, and I was just saying that I know you've done a lot of research into this period. What intrigues me, Amy, is that you've come upon facts about this period that I didn't know. We've heard so much about the 1940s, about the war, you know, just coming out of the Depression, but there are things in here where I just thought, did this happen? Did this actually happen? And each thing I asked you this morning, you said, yes, that really happened.
Well, you know, one of the great pleasures of research, it's like walking through this enormous garden as a writer. And there are so many facts, and you get to choose the ones that support the story, not that slow down the story.
Does it lead you somewhere in the story? Does that research affect what your characters do, or do they lead the way all the time?
I would say they usually lead the way, but just like in life, when you're traveling, every once in a while you come upon something and you have to change your plans. When I discovered that the United States interned 11,000 Germans, not German nationals, not people who were prisoners of war, people who lived in this country, who had come to this country as infants, but had not gotten around to getting citizenship, those people were in what were essentially fairly benign internment camps. When I say fairly benign, I mean that people had three meals a day, they had a roof over their head, they had their own cot, and they were surrounded on 10 acres by barbed wire and guard dogs and sentries at each corner. And they were informed in a list of rules after it said, make your bed, show up for breakfast. It said, crossing the barbed wire, you will be shot.
I am so familiar with the Japanese Americans who were interned in this country, but I didn't know about the Germans.
I think another thing that was fascinating to me was the fact that there were these little blue books, which were one of my great discoveries. One of the wonderful things about this country is that during a period where most people did not go to college, and in fact, many, many people left school after eighth grade, this guy came up with these little pamphlets called little blue books. They were a nickel apiece. Eventually, they were a dime. There were thousands of them on thousands of subjects. So if you were self-taught or wanted to understand something, you could get a little blue book on everything from the essential principles of psychoanalysis to the proverbs of Japan to how to make your own candy to what every married woman needs to know. There were no subjects that were left out. There were almost no poets that were left out. It had the short stories of Oscar Wilde and the short stories of Balzac and the wit and wisdom of Persia.
I could not believe that that was real. There's something about that I found so touching to me, that people were just trying so hard to better themselves.
It is, and it's one of the really moving things, because it was important at that point to be educated, not just to be popular and not just to be known to a social circle, but to actually know things. And people craved that information.
I've described Lucky Us as being a reflection not only of this period and all these fascinating things that went on then, but a very intimate look at these kinds of people that represent so many aspects of our human lives. So I describe your novel this way, but it is always more interesting for me to see what you think this story is about. What is this novel to you?
Well, for me, the setting in the 40s is very important, but it is not the center of the book. The center of the book are the things that I always write about. It's about the creation of family. It is about love and sex and romance and the connections between parent and child and siblings. And those connections are not always the ones that you're born with. Sometimes they're the ones that, if you're lucky, you get to make. And that was really part of where the idea of Lucky Us came from.
It's about resilience, because we see people to whom so many things have happened who don't always find a way, but some of them do. And so you get to witness this, you know, what goes into creating resilience in somebody. There are a couple characters, there's one in particular I can't stand. And she represents, what should I say? It's worse than ruthlessness.
Well, you know, not every character that is compelling is likable, although I find them lovable, not in the cuddly sense, but in the sense that I see them. And for me, it is like love, which is that you see them, you see their faults, but they are part of you anyway. And absolutely, ruthlessness comes from that sense of, I must have this, and nothing that is in my way matters more than this thing that I must have. There are people who are ruthless in their commitment to having a baby, or adopting a baby, or a lover, or a job, or a title, or a hit. And for those people, nothing else is real.
And that brings us to the complexity of loyalty. When people should stay, when they should go, how far they will go to achieve their ends. And so this is thought-provoking, very, very thought-provoking.
Well, I think that it is, in the sense that who you want on your side is someone who has some ruthlessness. Because if you're in the foxhole, if you are in the trenches with somebody, you want somebody who will not quit. And the other side of that is that when the guns stop, in some sense, when the crisis is over, you're still stuck with somebody who's pretty ruthless. But it is not a quality that doesn't have an important and necessary quality to it.
As we can see. We're talking with Amy Bloom, who has written what New York Magazine has just called one of the 6 books of the summer. It's called Lucky Us. It's just come out. It's set in the 1940s, has an irresistibly steamy Hollywood orgy scene that's is quite something. I guess that's what makes it a summer read, right? I don't know why that's
I hope what makes it a summer read is the fact that it's coming out at the end of July. It's my wish, certainly, well, that people will be reading it in November.
Well, you like to have, you know, the whole spectrum of, yes, of human possibilities in your summer read. So what was the toughest part to write?
I think the toughest part to write for me is always the sad parts or the terrible parts or the tragic parts. They're just painful. When terrible things are happening in the world of my characters, I see it. You know, I see what burns down. I see what is broken. I see what is taken away. And I feel it. And those things are hard to write.
Do you grieve for them when you're out of the studio, the writing studio?
I do grieve for them. I feel for them that life has brought this to them. Now, of course, if I was a different kind of person, I might think to myself, well, life didn't bring it to them, Amy. You brought it to them. But I write about life. And my experience of life is not that it is a seamless ribbon of butterscotch candy.
What is it?
It is good and bad.
It's messy.
It is messy. It is difficult. It is the storm and the sea and the harbor and the port and the sailor coming home. It is all of those things. It's not just one of them.
Your last novel, Away, for you, what is different in this novel, Lucky Us? Or maybe put another way, does that question matter?
Well, I suppose it matters in the sense that if you read my work, you might want to know, how is this not that? How is this like that? If I liked it, will I like this? If I hated it, will I like this? Those are the questions that come up, I think. Away, I think, had some of the same quality of being both epic, in other words, covering a lot of time and a lot of geographic space, but also intimate in the sense that it was around a small group of characters. But I would say the way in which it was different is that at the heart of Away, there is a wound that does not heal. And I would say at the heart of Lucky Us,
the new one.
Yeah, the new novel, there is possibility. And there is a blossoming forward into the world, despite the wounds. And I would say also there is just more playfulness. In my short stories, people often comment on my sense of humor. I think that comes out more in this novel than it has in previous novels. I know that there are scenes that are just plain funny. And that
that's true.
That was different.
So I'm trying to find out or get at how cinematic you are as a writer. There are often scenes that come alive in that cinematic way, and I think, what is it that I mean by that? Why are there some pages or paragraphs that seem so much more visual in novels that I'm reading? And so in this one, I see a lot of that.
Well, I think we say cinematic because we live in a world of television and movies, and we are used to seeing things on the screen. I think before movies and before television, we just would have thought of these scenes as very visually alive, because that's how I see them. I see them in my head. I see them happening, not as if they are in a movie, but as if they are right in front of me. Although I am sitting at my desk, it is as if the road and the car and the diner are right there at my feet.
Can you learn to do that?
I don't know if you can learn to do that. I think you can encourage people to see the world that they are writing about, but you also have to be willing to enter it, because it's not a matter when you're writing about it, of describing it, it's a matter of making it happen in front of the reader's eyes.
I just read a New York Times article, you know, where these researchers say that they were looking at the brain with equipment while giving people the assignment of writing. It was difficult to do, but they said the more experienced the writer, the more change they saw in the brain in a part that is not activated very much. And that was the most fascinating part to me. That here was living proof that as you get better and better at this, different parts of the brain light up in writers like you.
Well, I feel that way in the sense that I feel that when I am seeing it, it is not about me. And it's not like a little performance of a play. It's the world itself has just cracked open, and these things are happening right now. I am standing in the middle of the floor at the orgy. I am standing in Bian Carney's beauty salon in East Brooklyn while Evie sweeps up. I'm just there in the corner, and nobody sees me. But it's happening right in front of my eyes, and then my job is to write it so that it happens in front of your eyes.
And do those scenes, you know, as is true in everyday life as things happen around us, do those scenes produce that whole range of emotions? I mean, do you feel afraid sometimes? Do you feel, you know, utter joy and glee? Do you feel fury when you see this world crack open?
I do. I feel all of those things, which is why you never choose which character you identify with. You identify with all of them. In fact, you don't even identify with them. You are them. And so there's a moment later on in the novel where Eva, who's now in her late teens, meets a psychic. And he basically tells her her future. And it is both humiliating and exciting. And I remember as I was seeing that scene, feeling those things and my hands getting sweaty because I was so anxious about what was going to happen to me, meaning Evie, later on.
There are tarot cards in here, you know, talk about the future. And, you know, I'm always fascinated with the art of tarot card reading done well, you know. It's really quite a fascinating thing to me. You know, there's quite a bit in your novel about this.
Well, there is. And part of it comes from the fact that when I was 17, my part-time job was to be a shill for Madame Rosa, who was down in the village in New York. And every Friday and Saturday night, my job was to stand there in my platform sandals and my shorts and my long hair and say, "Madame Rosa, $5. She knows everything."
This is real.
This is real. And that's how I learned everything about
reading
cards.
How'd you get that job?
I was walking past her one day and I knocked and she did my cards and I said, "Oh my gosh, I don't have $5, which was completely typical of me at the time. I have $4. And she said, "Well, make up the extra buck. Why don't you stand in front of my shop and tell people to come on in?" And that particular evening, I got three people to come on in, two women and a man. And thus began our relationship.
This is Amy Bloom. Her new novel is out. It's called Lucky Us. When you describe that the world has cracked open for you as a writer and you see these things as they're happening to each of the characters in this book, I think that does give me the feeling that each of your characters deserves his or her own novel. I think that's what gives me that sense. Now, to see that scene, or not just see the scene, because that's too distant, to be in the room with them, in the car, wherever it is, and so that you are part of the action in a certain way. You are that person. The words that come from that, what is that? You know, that's the mystery of novel writing.
Well, the words come if you're a writer. If you're not a writer, you just have the experience.
But the words that are distinct or original to you, you know, we have E.L. Doctorow's words. I've compared this new novel to him here. You have Hilary Mantel. These words are you. That's why we come to novels, to experience you witnessing something.
It is as if you pour the experience that you have had as the character into the vessel that is your own particular language. And then it goes on the page. And so then what I give the reader is my shaping of the character's experience in both the character's language and through my eyes. So it's always actually two lenses. It is the writer's lens and the character's experience. And you put those things together, and God willing, you have a mastery of the word. And there is the sentence that is like no other sentence that conveys an experience that the reader can identify with and have without having actually lived through World War II or been a hairdresser or been a psychic or been a fake psychic or performed an emergency tracheotomy.
Is this why we hear every once in a while novels tell us how to live?
I guess so. I mean, I hope that novels tell us how to live. I also hope that they tell us how not to live. I also hope that they tell us how to look at our lives. I hope they also say to us, watch out, cliff coming. But if you go over the cliff, here's what it's like.
Thank you so much. Congratulations to you. Amy Bloom, her brand new novel is out, has received many starred reviews, was called by New York Magazine recently one of the 6 books of the summer. Lucky Us, published by Random House. In an age with so much information, the game is to know change is inevitable. The science of rolling with it. That's next. Don't go away. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR, FaithWNPR. Join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. Not long ago, we asked you, our listener, for show ideas. And one of you, Lynn Garner, tweeted us about this book. So here we go. The more complex life gets, the more we want certainty, especially true right now in this digital age. And many people, some of the best, in fact, are ready to deliver certainty in science, math, art, language, history, you name it. Example, a certain number of planets. It's a certainty, end of story, until we discovered a new one and more after that. And then I think we eliminated one. What if facts, what we consider facts, have a half-life? What if everything we know has an expiration date? Most of all, what if understanding that helps us make wiser choices and leads to even more discoveries? My guest, Samuel Arbisman, has written this fascinating book, The Half-Life of Facts. It's a journey into the counterintuitive fabric of knowledge itself. He's not trying to create a world of contrarians. He's explaining how to measure our world and accept the limits of how much we can know with certainty. There's a whole science built around this now. It's not known very much. You're about to be in the know. Mr. Arbisman is an applied mathematician, network scientist, and a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard. Isn't that a mouthful? Sam, we're Skyping him. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be on the show.
So everybody's probably afraid at this moment. This sounds so heady, and everybody might be saying, oh, are we going to be able to understand this? But I know you're very good at explaining these things. So scientometrics, this is what the field is called. What does that mean?
Essentially, scientometrics is the science of science. It's the science of measuring how science grows and changes. And many scientists, they know that there's certain regularities to how knowledge grows. So maybe there's an order of magnitude more papers in their own field than there was 10 years ago, or it's maybe becoming harder to discover things in certain fields. But it turns out, rather than just saying, oh, these are interesting intuitive notions, let's actually measure them. And so scientometricians, people who study scientometrics, the science of science, have actually begun trying to actually understand how science grows and changes by looking at papers and how scientists collaborate with each other, and even looking at how scientists receive grants or don't receive grants. And so it turns out there's actually some nice math to understand how science works.
Mostly they're using sophisticated computer systems to analyze this stuff and coming out with real results.
Oh, yeah. So and one of the reasons you have to use computers to do this is just scientific knowledge is so big that if you wanted to comb through the vast scientific literature and find any sort of signal within all the noise, you really couldn't do that by hand. So you need computers to actually go through and find the meaning and say, okay, now we actually know how fast papers grow in different fields, or what the structure of the network of connections looks like between authors in their own field and even between different fields. And so computers have now actually made a lot of this possible.
There's a story you tell at the beginning of the book that is so fascinating to me, and I would love for you to tell it as quickly as you can, about this man who stacks up a bunch of journals. I forget, is he storing them? And he all of a sudden looks at them and says, wait a minute, I see a pattern. And this leads to a huge discovery about knowledge.
Yeah, so the man is Derek J. DeSola-Price, and he's considered to be one of the founders of Scientometrics. And he actually was doing some of this before computers. Instead of computers, he had, I think, a lot of students to take the place of computers. What he did, he had recently gone to Raffles College, which is now the National University of Singapore. And the university was fairly small at the time, and so the library, it was being renovated when he got there. And they didn't have any place to store the books. They were giving the books to store in the homes of students and faculty. And so he received a complete set of a scientific journal, brought it home, and stacked it in time-ordered piles against the walls in his apartment. And one day he was looking at the heights of the piles, and he realized the heights, that they weren't evenly. They weren't even heights, but they also weren't of random height either. Instead, there was actually a clear mathematical curve to the height of the piles themselves. And he thought, this is kind of strange. And he began to collect more and more data, and he realized that it wasn't just the number of pages in a single scientific journal that obeyed certain mathematical properties. It turns out there were mathematical shapes to how knowledge grew in general. And so that was what kicked off the whole start of beginning to think about science itself as an endeavor in a mathematical way.
Yeah, so if you look at the shape of knowledge discoveries, it is a kind of curve, isn't it?
Yeah. So the most common curve that we see is what's known as exponential growth. And a lot of people know about this from Moore's law and technology, this successive doubling, which means that maybe initially when things double, so if you have one penny and you double it to two pennies, things go very, very slowly. But there's a certain point at which this successive doubling means things are growing really, really rapidly. And it turns out the same thing is true in a lot of scientific areas in terms of the number of papers that are growing in physics or in biology. And understanding that makes you realize that this endeavor of science and how it's growing is just unbelievably rapid.
So we can look at knowledge in the past. We could look at knowledge today. And maybe the best futurists do this to make their predictions. We can see how the curve, where we are on the curve, and how things are going to grow in the coming years and decades.
Exactly. Not always in the details, but we can understand the overall shape. And this is one of the reasons why I use this metaphor, this idea of the half-life, because the same thing is true in physics, that if you have a single radioactive atom, you can't predict when that atom is going to decay and break down. It could be in the next fraction of a second, or you might have to wait millions and millions of years. But when you get a lot of atoms together, suddenly things become regular and smooth. You can chart out a curve of the decay. You can actually encapsulate it within a single number, the half-life. And the same thing is true in science. I can't predict which specific discovery is going to occur necessarily. I also can't predict which specific discovery is going to be overturned. But when I look at science as a whole, there suddenly are regularities and patterns that emerge, and we can actually study this using the language of mathematics.
If we look at the past and we look at today and we say, let's put all knowledge out there in these discoveries, and we've got this curve over this span of time, where are we right now? Because everything certainly feels fast. It feels as if we have discoveries every minute. First is a planet, then they're taking one away. Smoking was healthy for us some time ago, and now it's deadly. These facts are changing and new things are occurring. Where do we right now exist on the curve?
You're definitely correct that things are moving incredibly rapidly, and it depends how we measure it. So some measures, such as the number of new scientists being created, it turns out we're actually slowing down a little bit. We're still generating many, many scientists, but at least within the United States, I don't believe we're actually creating them at the rate that we used to. Although, that being said, the number of scientists is mm-hmm. exploding. On the other hand, though, we are generating more and more knowledge because of also this interplay between the rapid growth of technology and the rapid growth of science. So, for example, through Moore's law and computers, as we have more and more impressive computational power, we're able to then subject scientific data to more and more sophisticated analysis. As we create bigger and better particle accelerators, we can learn more and more about the fundamental parts of physics, or even create new chemical elements. So the periodic table is changing, and often changing because of improvements in our tools and technologies. So there's this vast interplay, and technology is continuing to grow quite rapidly, and that often affects how we understand science. And when you're saying in terms of things being overturned, as science grows, as the number of scientists grow, as the number of studies grow, not only are we learning new things about the world, but as we improve our measurements and subject previous studies to re-examination, we often end up overturning things we thought were true. So this rate of change is quite fast. And there are certainly arguments to say it might be slowing down sometime soon. I'm not really sure they're true. It seems like we're going pretty quickly right now.
So the sense that we have, that innate sense that things are moving so fast, I sometimes say to myself, well, they must have felt like that at the Industrial Revolution time. And this is just what happens if you happen to be born into one of these transitional periods. But it is actually true that things are being overturned at a very rapid rate right now. So what's the inner positioning that we should have about this? How do we look at what is presented as fact? If I go on vacation and come back and read the past 3 weeks of newspapers, I see that things really didn't turn out quite the way they always say they are. So how do we position ourselves? Do we say, interesting for the moment, not necessarily a fact? What's the best position to take?
So I would say there's a few different ways to understand it. So one, if you can understand the regularities behind how knowledge changes, it won't be as surprising. But in addition, though, I think we need to have a better sense of distinguishing between the core of knowledge and the frontier. So the core of knowledge are the bits of information that make it into the textbooks. Sometimes these things do change, but we have a pretty good handle on these facts as being actually a true representation of the world around us. On the other hand, we have the scientific frontier. These are the new discoveries and the new papers that are being written every week. These are really, really exciting, and these are the ones that make the news, but they're often part of that flux and change at the edge of what we know. And so therefore, they are more likely to be overturned. They also happen to be the ones that we see more often in the news. Mm. And so it can seem that things are being overturned more often than science as a whole is really turning over, because we still have this very steady core while the frontier is entirely in flux. And that being said, though, this is the reason scientists want to work at the frontier. It's because where we know the least but where the most exciting things are happening. And I think one of the ways to help deal with all this is actually to assume some of the perspective of the scientists themselves. And the reason they are excited is because we don't necessarily know things and where things are being overturned. So I had a professor in graduate school. He told me this great story that he went in to his class on a Tuesday, gave a lecture, and the very next day read a paper that invalidated everything he had taught the day before. So he came in on Thursday and he said to the class, "Remember what I taught you on Tuesday? It's wrong. But if that bothers you, get out of science." And so the idea is that scientists need to actually understand that what we know is constantly in a draft form. And I think if the larger public can actually recognize this as well, we'll have a much healthier attitude towards understanding and actually having a certain amount of, not necessarily truth, but like a confidence in what scientists are doing, but at the same time recognizing that this endeavor is constantly in draft form. But that being said, it's still very exciting, and it still has helped us to understand the world and harness technology in the world around us.
Well, it's awe-inspiring to read all these things that are happening so fast. Really, it's awe-inspiring. Also confusing. It's what causes us to run out and take a particular pill, because there's been a lot of publicity about, you know, the health benefits of X, Y, or Z, and then 5 years goes by and they say, actually, it's killing you. So the question is, how do we know when to take action on something?
That's a very good question. And my sense and my feeling is that you have to have a certain amount of confidence in what's being reported, but at the same time recognize that when things are being overturned, that's often because effect sizes are sometimes small, and this is at the margin of what we know. We still have a very great deal of confidence in the rest of what we know, and so therefore we shouldn't kind of throw the informational baby out with the bathwater and say, oh, because this thing is wrong, therefore we're going to throw out everything and say, just because this one pill is now shown to be maybe harmful or not as effective as we thought, therefore I can't really trust everything or anything at all. I think mm-hmm. that's a bad way to operate. Most of what we know is still accurate and a pretty good way of understanding the world around right. us. And so I think we have to say, let's have confidence in these reported findings, but if things get overturned, we have to recognize this is part of the scientific process, and this is part of a continuing approach to the truth. And along the way, we're going to get things wrong,
yeah.
but if we have a healthy understanding of that, I think that's that's okay.
You have just explained part of why people are demonizing government. I mean, certainly there are a lot, for 20 years, it has been the political game to say government is bad, and of course that has an effect on people. But all people have to see is government making a mistake here or there, not understanding that you try things, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. And so if those two things, if there's a bullhorn saying government is bad and you see a piece of evidence to document that, it can cause people to say, oh, yeah, that's right, government is bad because they failed over here in this little section.
Yeah, I think this is true in all aspects of life science or otherwise, that an incremental experimental process is good because it helps us actually verify and test what we know and what we think we don't know. And yeah, in making sweeping generalizations, it's easy, but it's not a very scientific way to understand the world around us.
So what are the implications? Doctors, you point out, will have a rough idea of when their knowledge is likely to expire, and then they can keep up with the latest research. There really is a reason to read your journals. And then companies and governments, in understanding how long new discoveries take, they can figure out where the resources should go. So this is how government can get better, and this is how companies can get better.
Yeah, no, I think so. And I think of the fields that have internalized this message of changing knowledge, best it is, and it certainly is medicine, because in that case, lives are literally on the line. And so physicians are now taught, and medical students are taught, that a large fraction of what they learn is going to become obsolete within a few years of their graduation. They have continuing medical education. And I think this sort of approach of continuing education needs to be done in every single field. And otherwise, a friend of mine, he was talking to, I think, someone in the world of finance who is very esteemed. And he was telling a story, beginning an anecdote. And he said, oh, as you all know, due to the world only having 4 billion people, blah, blah, blah. And everyone was shocked because they're like, 4 billion people? This hasn't been true for quite some time. And of course, maybe he was just telling a story. But if he's actually making financial decisions based on this terribly out-of-date fact of the world, that can be really, really bad. And so I think we need to find better ways to stay abreast of all different aspects of information. And when it's your own field, you have a greater impetus to do that. And the truth is, due to information overload and the information explosion, it's not always entirely clear how we can best do this. And one of the ways, actually going back to the world of finance, I often view it as like we can maybe take a page from index funds. So if your job is in the world of finance and you're a professional investor, you can actually spend the time doing research to really understand what to invest in. But if you don't, you invest in the market and you invest in index funds. And this way, at least you know you're kind of in line with the market. And I think we might need the equivalent of informational index funds for people, that they can actually try to stay abreast with all the knowledge and recognize when things are changing. And it's not entirely clear what that is. The Atlantic's website actually has a series called The Atlantic Media Diet, where it speaks to a number of well-known people and says, how do you get your information and how do you stay abreast of the world's news? And possibly looking at how other people do that can give you a sense of maybe how to deal with all this information overload around you.
And we're seeing President Obama facing this as he tells scientists to give them the mission of mapping the brain. How is that going to go? We've seen people using these big computers to search emotional words in fiction and finding out that we're at the lowest point in, I think, a century of the use of emotional words or emotion in fiction. So that's interesting. So you will see this information unfolding as we go on. Thanks to your book, I now know it's Scientometrics. There are so many interesting ideas about collaboration in this book and how discoveries have come from people not even connected or educated about a particular science and jumping in and helping because of some other outside-the-box expertise and a new way of looking at something. Very interesting book, Sam. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
The Half-Life of Facts, Why Everything We Know Has an Expiration Date. Samuel Arbesman, Arbesman, The Half-Life of Facts. As always, this show is about the richness of life. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.